going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thank you so much, Capital. I am certainly Donovan Bennett, and this is certainly the Going Deep podcast. And you know me, I love me some sports streamers. I love me a docuseries. And if there is a good one, I'm certainly going to consume it, and I'm going to tell you about it. I'm going to bring on the principal people behind making it to figure out what is the secret sauce in making these series that we love and consume so much. But in this conversation, given the level of expertise of our guests, I also wanted to know, maybe not just where the puck is, but where the puck is going in terms of this type of storytelling. I'll tell you what I mean in a minute. If you haven't heard already, I'm here to tell you that Netflix Full Speed, giving you all of the great racing and drama and insight innovation coming out of NASCAR, is back for season 2. So look forward to that. Make sure you are tuning in this spring. We know that these series don't always get season 2, so it's an affirmation of how good season 1 was. And in many ways, it was groundbreaking, even though this is certainly a busy genre. And that's actually where my mind goes and what I'm curious about and what I want to talk to our guests about. First, Aaron Cohen, Chief Creative Officer for Words and Pictures. You remember we had a conversation about Celtic City not too long ago. Words and Pictures brought us that, and they bring us this. And Aaron specifically has brought us a lot. One of the most decorated writers and producers in the history of documentary sports television, 32 Emmys and a Peabody Award, including a Dick Schaap Award for Outstanding Writing at the Sports Emmys 9 different times. So he is him, as the kids would say. Currently, he's the Chief Creative Officer and Executive Producer as Words and Pictures, which means he's been instrumental in Netflix NASCAR Full Speed, HBO Celtic City, which again, I love, the Amazon's Game 7, and HBO's The Lionheart, which you shouldn't sleep on either. And with him, we have a conversation as well with John Dahl, Senior Vice President of Content for NASCAR, and who is not new to this, but is true to this as well. He's a veteran from his days at ESPN as an executive producer and key creative lead behind documentary programming like 30 for 30, obviously, and the Emmy Award-winning docuseries The Last Dance. So the resumes are long. This conversation for me could not be long enough, but I'm so thankful they shared some time to talk to me about NASCAR Full Speed Season 2 on Netflix, but also where the genre is going and what we should look for as an audience in our storytelling. Let's go deep.
The intensity of the playoffs gets raised significantly tonight.
People ask me, they're like, well, you won the championship last year. How do you top 24?
Oh, my goodness.
There's just so much on the line. There's so many different storylines.
Going into this weekend, I feel cheated.
We have the tiebreaker over William, and then I realize nobody's celebrating.
We sent our boy to war on a donkey holding a wooden spoon.
If you make the wrong move, it all unravels.
We're in the playoffs. What's the plan now?
White about to give birth.
I'm starting to get terrified. I'm not going to lie.
I don't feel bad for him.
10-4, man, are you okay?
This is life.
Some of the closest finishes in NASCAR history decided by that much.
Wins it by an eyelash.
The bloodbath back there, man.
Oh, my goodness.
As soon as you think you know what's going to happen, boom.
Here we go.
Ready. Green, green, green. You're gonna feel my
fire, baby. Well, Aaron, John, thank you for spending the time, and thank you for coming together and agreeing to give us more great coverage of NASCAR and in-depth storylines and the real, you know, behind the curtain peek at the sport. One that I have to be honest, I was not really familiar with. I understood, at least I thought I understood, you know, the culture and obviously the legacy, but to be able to, you know, almost feel it through the screen was real impressive. And I'll maybe start there with you, John. You have such a rabid fan base, both in North America, but, you know, but also a strong one internationally. When you look at the potential goals you wanted in this type of storytelling, and maybe things that you wanted to reinforce, and maybe things that weren't known that you wanted to expose, what did those goals look like?
The goals really center around a common mission, which is to get people to care more about our drivers and our teams, so that, you know, it's not just cars going in circles every Sunday, but they know the people, they feel like they know the people, and they're more compelled to watch because we're giving them a chance to get to know them on and off the track and get to know their lives and who's in their lives. And if we give more reasons to care, we believe we can broaden the audience for NASCAR.
It's obviously a small sample thus far, but what are the key performance indicators? Have you noticed increase understanding, brand affinity, discoverability, audience numbers based off of what you've done thus far?
Yeah, I think one thing that really jumped out at me was season one of Full Speed. In the first week, the amount of people watching, the people who were watching, 90% of them had not seen the championship race. So, you know, Full Speed, we're focusing on the playoffs. Season one focused on the 23 playoffs. Season two, coming out on May 7th, focuses on the 2024 playoffs. So that, to me, is remarkable that we release the series, and in the first week of watching, 90% of the people didn't see the playoff race and the championship race the previous fall.
Aaron, when it comes to you and your group at Words and Pictures, I'm sure the inbox is full of lots of opportunities, especially in this space where, you know, post, you know, what Box to Box did with Drive to Survive, everyone in every league seems to want to do something like this. Why did this opportunity make sense for you with this sport and you know, this group?
Oh, so many reasons. I mean, look, you know, it's a fun, it's a real, I think, specific world to explore. And like John said, you know, we're looking to hit two different audiences. We're looking to appeal to the diehard fan who watches every race and then, but just give me more, right? Take me further behind the scenes. And you know, that's the philosophy of storytelling. You know, even some of the people who do know the results, you know, would love to relive it in a way, and we're really making a movie about the most exciting part of the season, the playoffs. And then, like John said, you're looking to really, you know, open the aperture and try and grab more casual sports fans who might not think of themselves as NASCAR fans, but the show, you know, will bring them in. And that's really the philosophy we and our team at Words and Pictures brought to it. We, you know, candidly, our creative folks, we're not NASCAR diehards themselves. And so we were, in season one, we were kind of exploring the world, learning about the world along with the viewer. And I think we found things interesting that people inside of NASCAR would have said, oh, really? You think that's interesting? It's like, yeah, no, let's keep going with certain driver, you know, personalities. And also just, you know, in terms of scoping out the world. So I'm a big believer in storytelling of, if you can do something that appeals to everyone, that wider group, it will also on the way very much appeal to the diehards. Those aren't mutually exclusive at all. And I thought NASCAR, you know, just provided a great landscape to do that.
I want to follow up on those two audiences and balancing that, because you have the challenge, I would argue, especially with this sport, where you don't want to insult the existing audience, but at the same time, you need to bring the new audience up to speed quickly. How did you balance those two things in both pre and post-production in terms of how you were going to lay out the storylines?
Look, my again, my philosophy is that it, you know, anybody who's listening to a story, even if you know it, wants, you know, the full story. To pick it up in the second inning or the 40th lap, just, you know, I don't think it appeals to anyone. Like, for example, you know, I live in New York. I'm a big Knicks fan. If a general interest magazine did a profile on the Knicks where it was a reporter who kind of came in who doesn't normally cover the team, I would gobble up that article because it's a new perspective, and I wouldn't be bothered if they had to explain basic elements of the team or the dynamics of the game that I already knew. So I think if you can do it in an intelligent way, and a compelling way, period, it's going to appeal to everyone. And so, look, that was the philosophy we took in when, you know, you certainly the playoffs do have a, you know, are a little complicated to explain. And so, you know, to a broader audience. And so we did that in season one in kind of a creative way by having the drivers tell us in a certain kind of interview. We briefly do it again in season two. And that's fine. I think the diehard audience, you know, is fine to go along with that.
Without, you know, naming any of the other sports-specific docuseries specifically, there has been, by some hardcore fans, a reaction to some that it skews a little bit too close to reality TV and a Cole's notes of what happened and not actually a documentary storytelling of what happened. Did you, in going into these projects, do you feel that pressure and feel a need to try to make sure that the storytelling is authentic to how things played out?
Look, and John can jump in here. You know, we both, John and I originally collaborated at ESPN as on the on 30 for 30 and other docuseries we did across ESPN, SEC Network, and other places. So, and if you root back where we come from, there's a journalism background there. These shows, you're absolutely right, Donovan, have, you know, can feel that way. And look, our philosophy in Words and Pictures is there's nothing better than the real story. So I think we did a pretty good job of finding the drama in what really happened, finding the themes in what really happened, and staying true to those stories. Candidly, the drivers themselves, particularly in NASCAR, I don't think were that are that, I wouldn't say willing because I don't even want to be willing, but that interested in gumming up the drama in a different way, which requires us as storytellers to lean into the real thing, you know? So, and in season two, we had some great storylines in terms, you know, at the top of the sort of contenders where you had Ryan Blaney and Joey Logano, teammates, okay, who are helping themselves or helping each other throughout the season a little bit and in the early part of the playoffs and then ultimately having to square off for the championship. You have, you know, Chase Briscoe, you know, a driver on who barely gets into the playoffs, who's trying to navigate, you know, changing teams, and also his wife's about to have twins. So these were like real stories, or it's just like, hey, we're good. Like we'll just roll camera and go. So that's definitely the way we lean.
Yeah, I think NASCAR, I think we are exceptionally authentic. I mean, we put it all out there. The radio transmissions of all the drivers during the races, you hear it unfiltered, raw. Nobody's putting them up to it. And then we put it out there. We don't edit it down. We have this weekly feature, Radioactive, where it's, you know, the best of the, you know, radio moments during that previous week's race. And it's exceptionally entertaining, just to, and insightful and enlightening to hear what they're saying during the race, warts and all. And there was just a big news story this week between Joey Logano and Chipper Jones, Hall of Fame baseball player. Logano was caught on the radio, you know, criticizing his teammate, Austin Cindric. And it was just out there for everybody to consume. And Chipper then had his opinions about, you know, what's a good teammate. So I think that's an example where we don't have to contrive anything. It's naturally there. And I think if we started to try to create certain outcomes or situations or rivalries that didn't naturally exist, people would see right through it.
Well, also what's naturally there, though, is attention, because that is, I would say, easier said than done, where any league, you know, there's a tension between the teams and the players want to focus on whatever it means to win. In the league, winning means driving the business and fandom and entertainment and how you balance those two things. How do you get buy-in for a project like this across the board? How difficult is that conversation?
Well, I know Aaron can speak to this as well. I just say that, you know, I think what you're doing is reminding him of how this helps us all. We all benefit if they're willing to show more of themselves as human beings. It's an elite group of drivers. And so we think that just makes them more relatable, more compelling, and that drives people to want to see what they do on the track from week to week.
When we look at season two, Aaron, what should we expect? Anything unique or different going into the season than what we would have previously seen or expected?
We're just as excited about season two as we were about season one. You know, season one had a certain focus on certain drivers, and we tried to expand the cast. Like I mentioned, we have more from Joey Logano, though he was in season one, though he got eliminated in the first round in season one, obviously had a better result in season two. Chase Briscoe, Harrison Burton, there's more with Christopher Bell. So we just tried, you know, there were drivers who had kind of minor roles in season one who we thought could have a bigger role in season two. And there were drivers who, you know, weren't in season one who we brought in. So we tried to move the cast around. NASCAR obviously tweaks, you know, the beginning of the playoffs in terms of locations, and that changed some of the plot lines. But we really just followed the story and continued to kind of try and shine a light on as many different parts of the sport and as many different facets of the personalities of the drivers as we could. And we were really pleased with the result.
I want to follow the story of this type of storytelling, especially at a place like Words and Pictures. This market can quickly become oversaturated as we get more seasons and more leagues and sports interested. Are we close? Is there a nexus there? Where do you think this goes as so many people look to use the platform of sports to tell stories in this medium?
Look, I think it's a fantastic question. I think that in some ways, the idea, I mean, yes, there are the way we watch our, you know, sports storytelling now has changed in the sense of the advent of these platforms, like, you know, these great places like Netflix and Amazon and, you know, Apple and so forth. But these shows have been around for a long time, starting in the 70s and with NFL films. HBO Sports did great work in the 2000s, you know, all the way through the 2000s with Hard Knocks and then 24/7 and boxing and hockey. So I think these shows will continue to flourish. And honestly, I would point to, if you want to find a show, you know, what are the characteristics of a series to make sure that the quality does maintain? It's about genuine storytelling and not, you know, not making it up, but also real buy-in from the athletes and the access and trust, really. I think you need the athletes, the competitors, and people in the, you know, in the shows to trust the producers to let them tell their stories. And the best outcomes in the shows that I've been involved with, again, dating back to like the first 24/7 hockey show at HBO, I think that was like a great moment. The NHL hadn't really been spotlighted in that way. And I remember that series, just the players not being, you know, too shielded with what they were going to do. And we found a lot of that with NASCAR too. I mean, we got great trust and buy-in from drivers like Ryan Blaney and Chase Briscoe and Christopher Bell. And so I think when they're more open and more real, you just let the cameras roll and go. So as long as that access remains genuine, as long as that storytelling remains genuine, I think as long as fans love sports, these shows will continue to have a certain popularity.
Yeah, and I think as long as there's a story to tell too, like just access in and of itself is not enough. You do have to have a story to tell. And I think we get it in Full Speed Season 2 with Daniel Suarez, for example. His story is really remarkable. Last year, became an official U.S. citizen, got married to Julia Piquet from the legendary Piquet racing family. Her father, Nelson Piquet, a Formula One champion. Her brother, Nelson Piquet Jr., a Formula One driver. So she understands racing extremely well. You know, and through her relationship with Daniel, you get a sense of how she helps him, how their relationship works. You get a sense of how Daniel got here in the first place, you know, coming from Mexico on a dream to be a racer one day, and that it was his father who believed in him when maybe nobody else might have. His father was steadfast in his belief in him. And then we get to see a reunion scene where his father comes to Charlotte and they get together, and it's just a warm, wonderful moment. And you get a much better understanding of how Daniel got here and who are the key people in his life.
Well, lastly, the last word goes to you, John. I want a better understanding of what's next, because I'm sure this isn't the only thing you're thinking of. You know, you mentioned Radioactive. Obviously, Full Speed has been a great success. But whether it's, in the live event arena, you know, with the digital space and social, with storytelling like this, what are the other things you're looking to continue to do to push the envelope of the sport and expand its reach?
Well, we've got a multi-part documentary on Dale Earnhardt coming out on Amazon Prime Video Memorial Day weekend called Earnhardt, four parts. And I think it's an extraordinary look at Dale Earnhardt that the audience has not seen before, particularly through the perspectives of Dale Jr. and Kelly. I think it's an enormously impactful viewing experience. We've got a documentary, American Thunder, NASCAR to Le Mans, about the Garage 56 project embarked upon with Hendrick Motorsports 2 years ago. So those are some big projects. I think largely more philosophically, looking for projects that are going to have an impact, that really can move the needle. I think we're trying to be as discerning as possible about what we want to do and what are we accomplishing with that particular project. Beyond that, you know, we've got, our YouTube channel, our NASCAR YouTube channel, which we've been focused on growing, quite honestly. We just started a NASCAR channel 3 months ago on Tubi, and now it's expanding to other platforms. Fast platforms, which I think are, you know, a major part of where we're going. The free ad-supported streaming television, I think, is a marketplace you have to be in, is a platform you have to be in. So there are a number of things from NASCAR.com to what we're doing in the scripted and unscripted space. In the end, it's all a common goal of just broadening that audience, trying to reach more people. How do we reach people like my kids? My son is about to turn 15. My daughter's 18. They love sports. They're not necessarily naturally racing fans. How can we reach them? How can I entertain them? I think about them all the time as we're looking at our next ideas.
Thanks so much again to Aaron Cohen and John Dahl and everyone at Words Pictures and Netflix. Looking forward to this series coming up this spring. And as we pivot to docuseries, to scripted series, we stay in the lane of award winners. And that's what our next guest is. Manny Mahal is an award-winning writer, director, and producer. And he's more recently a co-producer slash writer for an episode of the CBC original series, Allegiance. Now, if you were following season 2, like me, the 8th episode, episode 208 technically, is really interesting. For those who haven't, Allegiance is a CBC police drama set in Surrey, BC. And unlike some of the other procedural dramas, it actually wants to unpack issues like identity politics, policing in underprivileged communities, the flawed justice system, which is, for me, pretty fascinating and refreshing. And it's also great, especially at a time when we are Canada First and Canada Strong, to see storylines from Surrey and Metro Vancouver play out on our television screen. So, needless to say, much more than your typical cop show. The show's had so much success after it first premiered last year in Canada on CBC that captured attention of audiences around the world. It's aired in other countries and continents, including Asia, Europe, Australia, South Africa, and Israel. And the tagline of this specific episode jumped out at me. I'm going to try my best promo VO voice. When a junior hockey team owner is gunned down after a championship game, the motive leads Sabrina and Zach to unexpected places. Now, that terrible read, it's not going to make you want to watch this episode, but hopefully the conversation that we have next with Manny will, because this episode looks at some systemic issues in hockey culture, like sexual assault, and the power dynamics that you have in spaces like junior hockey, specifically the code of silence that persists among players and the sexual abuse and assault that happens to young male players. Now, I'm not going to say too much more because I don't want to fully go spoiler alert on you, only to say you should watch it afterwards, but don't take my word for it. Let's talk to Manny Mahal about the issue at hand, the episode that he wrote and produced, and why he felt like this was the story he wanted to tell right now.
Manny, so excited to jump into this episode and really this issue with you. But I want to start back and talk about you writing on this project and how that came to be. There's so many times I'll be streaming a good show and I think to myself two things. One, where's this going? Like, where are they taking me? And two, how did this start? How did this kernel of an idea come to be? And so how did you get involved with the project and specifically the subject matter that we saw in this episode?
Well, yeah, I grew up playing hockey most of my life, and I ended up coaching it actually after I stopped playing for nearly a decade, all before I got into writing. So this was a world that I knew very, very well. And one aspect of the hockey world that I kind of wanted to explore, and I didn't know what direction it was yet, was how, in a way, how superstitious hockey players can be. That when they're on a winning streak, for example, everyone must do the exact same thing they did yesterday, for in just in case we might lose because someone sat in the wrong seat on the bus. And I thought how, you know, crazy that really is and how unbelievable that could be. But then I started thinking about how bad that could turn out if it's ever used in a negative way, you know, where it's something about not speaking out because the team's on a winning streak or something bad happens in a locker room and the players are forced to keep it quiet because they don't want to endanger this notion of winning. And that's kind of where it started. And then I started looking into research of situations like this. And, you know, I'd heard about horrible stories around, you know, the Theo Fleury case or the Sheldon Kennedy case and what happened to Kyle Beach during the Chicago Blackhawks run, in which they were on a winning streak. They were winning in the Stanley Cup Finals and the team decided to suppress the story of what happened to him. And I just wanted to explore that theme and really pin it on the forefront and have people talk about it.
I would love your perspective because although you are a writer, you come from the community, you understand the sport and the culture. And at times when you critique hockey culture, one of the immediate refrains is, well, you don't get it. You just don't understand on many levels, which I would say it's fair, probably true. But I've thought to myself, we don't see this as consistently in other sports than we do in hockey for whatever reason. And I wonder why that is. If we just randomly chose the national team for another sport in another country, we wouldn't be able to find the consistent level of mismanagement around sexual assault cases as we've been able to find in Hockey Canada. And that's just obviously one of sadly many examples. Why do you think that is? What's going on here?
I think it kind of does come down to the culture of hockey. And, you know, this came up recently, I think, with, if I can reference, like the Four Nations Cup and PK Subban's comments between hockey and basketball, for example, that there's a toughness level to hockey players. They play through injuries. They you know, they'll play for whatever. They care so much about the game that they'll play through all kinds of other things going on. And I think that hockey has this embedded nature of suck it up and play. You know, if something's going on physically with you, you play through it. So why not do the same mentally? And I think because of that, there's this underlying shadow that can occur in which players can easily compartmentalize. And it's part of the game to compartmentalize, you know, to flock in and focus. And I just think that there can be a dark side to that level of concentration and that stigma around, hey, we are here to win the game and nothing else. And nothing else, unfortunately, can involve issues like sexual assault.
I knew obviously where the episode was going because I was watching it in preparation for this conversation, but I found it real intriguing that as we're on a journey, you open our eyes up to many different issues when it comes to hockey and really, you know, minor and junior hockey in Canada, the funding, where the money's coming from and what is actually happening with the money. Parents feeling beholden to a coach in terms of a player's future, and even the criticism of players who maybe didn't make it to everyone else's aspirations, immediately going to potentially a character. And those are just the ones that jumped out to me as I was watching. What sort of conversation were you hoping to have around the sport at that level at large?
Well, again, a lot of those conversations and a lot of those things that I included in the episode were things that I had heard from being in coaches' rooms and meetings with parents and just seeing how the system of hockey is all around, again, what happens on the ice. There's all these little things happening off the ice that are so fascinating and so, in a way, nonsensical when you really remove the hockey aspect from it, like this idea of how, junior hockey is a place where no one really makes a lot of money, and yet there's a junior hockey team in every little town across Canada. And just that notion of how parents also buy into the dream. Like if I pay for this very expensive equipment or I pay for this level of coaching, my son or daughter might make it to the pros. And just that level of buy-in is something that I really wanted to explore again in this episode.
What, from your experience playing hockey, has dovetailed and has been transferable to your experience now working in film and working as a writer?
Well, as much as we're talking about this dark side of hockey, there is a huge positive aspect of growing up playing hockey too that I tried to include in this episode and I take very strongly in my writing now too. And that is actually the brotherhood, the bond you have amongst teammates. Like I will say, like the times that I've had in the locker room with my friends it's the equivalent of kind of, becoming brothers in a way. And in this episode, there is a friendship at the core of it, of these two teammates who would do anything for each other because they spent their whole lives playing hockey. And there's that incredible bond that it lasts much longer than after the game is done. And now kind of coming into writing, when I enter a writer's room, I really try to kind of have a locker room type experience, where I really try to bond my other writers in the same way that I would do with my hockey friends back in the day, whether that's playing games, having low competitive streaks going on, just that locker room environment that I thought when I played was such a great environment to collaboration, and back then it was on the ice and now it's on the page. So I really try to bring that atmosphere to my work now.
I imagine that at times during your career, when you walk into a writer's room, most of the people there looked different than you. And I assume walking into a hockey dressing room was the same. What I loved about this episode was you were able to shine a light on the participation, the fandom, the love for the sport being somewhat diverse, especially in our country. Why was the nuances around that aspect of hockey important for you to demonstrate?
I think it's because it was true to my own experience. You're absolutely correct that when I was playing hockey, I was one of the few Punjabi kids on the team. That's the background of my family. I was born here in Canada. My parents had come from India. And I also felt, similar to a similar extent here in writing in Canada right now. It's not the most diverse place, but it's definitely becoming more and more diverse. I think it's a huge, there's a huge push for that. And it's led to some really great storytelling. But in this episode, particularly, growing up here in Vancouver playing hockey locally, there was a lot, it was becoming more and more diverse as I was getting older in hockey. And what I loved about it is that I would meet parents who had no idea hockey existed at all. There's no Stanley Cup for them growing up. They had no idea who the Edmonton Oilers were, and they could care less about it. But what they really cared about was the happiness that hockey brought to their kids. And I really loved those parents the most in a way, that just the pure joy that their kids felt while they shivered to death at 6 a.m. in a freezing cold ice rink. And I just thought I really wanted to highlight that kind of a parent, you know, who really knows nothing about scoring goals or backhands, but just really wanted to make sure their son or daughter got to experience the joy of playing hockey.
That aspect is one of the reasons why I think what has been done with Allegiance is cool. You know, we look at the fact that it's a procedural drama, you know, one of those cop shows that historically we've loved, but historically they've been centered around, you know, the lead investigator detectives, they're white. And maybe diversity is the sidekick was a female, but, you know, this is certainly much more diverse cast, which we're starting to see a little bit more, but certainly not seeing someone who's Sikh Punjabi Canadian as a lead character in a show like this. That representation, but also the fact that you're not just solving cases, you're dealing with health addiction, you know, youth crime, restorative justice, policing BIPOC communities, etc., etc. What is it like for you to work on a show that isn't just following this old school formula, but is doing a little bit something different with the platform it has?
It's really probably the most exciting aspect of the job because, yeah, it is kind of a old, you know, tried and true formula. But the fact that we're using a completely different playground that we've never used before with different types of characters that we've rarely seen has actually just made it so much more fresh than I could have imagined. Because what's so fascinating about Allegiance and our central character played by Supinder Ratch, who's absolutely fantastic, is that she's policing a community that she grew up in. So she knows a lot of the people around. She knows the people who are impacted. She knows the suspects, the victims. And there's a nuance to trying to balance what everyone's perception of a police officer is, which I'm sure, as you know, isn't necessarily everyone's favorite type of person to meet on the street. And I think there's something that we try to explore in this show is that every time, you know, a police officer goes to work and is, you know, policing their community, that's a day in their life, that's a job for them. However, that person who interacts with them, most likely it's the worst day of their lives. It's to balance that idea that everyone a police officer meets, they're going through a very difficult time. And what in Allegiance, I think we brought forward was how empathetic you need to be to police your own community.
I love also that it's filmed in the community. And we have this conversation right now, certainly about supporting local and Canada First and what it means to invest in our own, you know, similar to Law and Order Toronto. I love the fact that Allegiance is filmed in Metro Vancouver with Canadian writer, Canadian actors, etc. How is the market right now for being able to do these things in Canada? It's being done here, but how readily available is that in terms of continuing to do it moving forward?
I think as far as it being readily available for, which is really all I can speak about, is that we are definitely ready and available for that. Like my own journey, for example, like I'm based here in Vancouver and I've been writing stuff for almost a decade, like for 10 years or so before anyone thought about reading it or anyone even thought about it being a potential job. And from people that I know out here in Vancouver, but in many cities across Canada, there are always writers, actors, directors, people making short films, people making feature films. We are out here doing as much as we can to make this art that is Canadian and to make, you know, to tell stories that are really important to us. And I think typically you have the market either, you know, all based in Toronto and for Canada, for example, or from LA or New York. And as soon as Allegiance first started, it was one of the first shows that really started with writers and actors and everyone from Vancouver kind of coming from this area. And, you know, the show has been a huge success, I think, because everyone's already readily available. And we're just proving that once you give us a shot, you know, you'll find that we might not be veterans of any kind just yet, but we've all been putting in our work and putting in our 10,000 hours and just kind of waiting for opportunity. And I think now is probably the best time to really focus on more Canadian stories and just have faith that the storytellers have been telling these stories even before they were on TV.
Well, it started last year on CBC already in season two. This was the eighth episode. And you talk about that success. It's, you know, aired in other countries, you know, in continents, quite frankly, across the world. So the fact that, you know, Canada is a bit of a microcosm of the entire globe benefits when you're looking to have these episodes air elsewhere. Before I let you go, what's next for the show, for yourself? What, as much as you can tell us, is in store for the future?
I will say this. I don't know. I'll say this, Donovan, that might be cut out, but I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that Allegiance is coming back for season three. It's just been announced to me and other writers. So I will need to check. I will tell you it in like a proper way, but you probably should check with Winston before I get in trouble. But to answer your question for what's next, I do think that we are coming back for season three of Allegiance and are going to dive deeper in to exactly what you said about Canada being a microcosm for the globe. We've already explored stories with, again, a very diverse cast in diverse languages. You know, not every single story is presented in English on Allegiance, which I think is very fascinating and true to Canada. And I, for one, is very excited to dive into that. Now, if you can't use that, in case that's not allowed, what I can say for myself is that I'm now, oh my God, wait, I'm working on another show that you also probably can't announce yet. Okay. Don't know if I can even answer your question, Donovan. I'm working on two shows at the moment that both may or may not be announceable. So I don't know if I should answer your question about what's next in that
that's
way.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Totally get it, which is exciting. Congrats.
Yes.
But totally get it. Well, if we'll check with Winston, and if we can use that answer, we will. And if not, then we won't. I'm excited for what's next for you personally. I'll be certainly keeping tuned, but also for the show. This was my entryway to it. But, you know, I had to go backwards and then go forwards and start from season one and continue to binge to where we are now. So continued success. And thank you for proving that it's possible and for making what are often really difficult conversations a little bit more palatable when you wrap them in to entertainment.
Of course. Appreciate it, Donovan.
Thanks again to Manny. And again, Allegiance is the show. All seasons are available to stream in Canada on CBC Gem, which is CBC's free streaming service. This is episode 8, season 2, 208. It's outstanding. Please watch it. And thank you for listening to this. Be sure to like, favorite, share, and subscribe. Talk to you again soon.